And welcome to the Commercial Real Estate Playbook. I am one of the co-hosts, Frank Scappaticci, without my partner, John. And I'm with Colin Redlon. I think I'm saying that a little fancier than you do, but did I get it right?
No, not at all. You made me sound very French and very bougie. It's Redlon, kind of like the drug.
Is it not French? What is the nationality for that?
The origin story is like Scottish, you know, Western Europe, kind of derived from Ridland, which was allegedly a province on the Isle of Skye in Scotland, then sort of turned into Ridley and Riddle. And then here we are today as Redlon or Redlon. But yeah, it would actually probably be easier if we just called it Ridland because then nobody would mess up the pronunciation.
Got it. I said it fancy and you somehow made it seem fancier. Well, welcome to the pod. I'm glad to have you on. We engage a lot on Twitter over the last 2 to 3 years, and we have similar backgrounds, which is why I thought this pod would be interesting. We're both Army vets. You're still a financial consultant. I used to be a consultant. I hated it. I don't know. We'll get to your thoughts on it. And yeah, we both do real estate too. So we got a lot of shared experiences. Before we get into anything particular, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and your journey, right? How'd you go from being an enlisted soldier, getting into McKinsey, and then bankrolling some of your own investments?
Yeah. So, well, thanks for the intro and, you know, thanks for having me on. Really excited to do it. First podcast. I'm hoping that nobody has to listen to it on 3x speed because my regular speaking cadence is 3x. So they might actually have to slow this one down to catch all the beats. But yeah, long winding story, which I think, you know, you and I both share, bounced around a lot as a kid, lived in 6 states before, you know, I even joined the military. Parents, my dad was an entrepreneur. My mom was a homemaker and then, you know, turned into a college professor. Then they split. I graduated. So after like, you know, spending some time as a professional musician, signed to Sony for 4 years.
What instrument? What'd you play?
Yeah. See, here's where we get into the fun parts, right? So, grew up in a musical household, started off playing drums, got into this rap sort of funk rock band in high school. That band merged with another, and we sold 6,000 tickets at our second show, got signed to like a local label in Maryland. So I was like a singer, like hip hop artist. We thought we were going to be, you know, rich and famous next Linkin Park. Our egos were bigger than our talent. We broke up after about like 7 months. I went to Chicago to pursue hip hop full time, got signed to Sony in 2003 on a singles deal. But made most of my money doing like voiceover and production work for Leo Burnett. We just like made tons and tons of singles trying to get Sony to come up off of a multi-album deal. Like that was the only way artists really made money back then, right? Like YouTube was nascent, SoundCloud was non-existent. But so anyway, I told myself like, if I'm not kicking down Eminem's door by the time I'm 25, I'm going to go back and get my undergrad. Here we are. So you can figure out how that story ends, right?
Wait, so what was your name? Like if someone wanted to find you on the iTunes store, what would they look for?
They would not look for anything because I don't exist. I've scrubbed it all. There's like maybe one Google Drive out there that houses all of my old hip hop music, but you'll never find it without like a personalized link. My rap name was Riddles. C Riddles was the long form, if you prefer. Went back.
This is genius though. You're creating a lot of scarcity. Right. So like what, you know, the future, if you become famous like that you're driving the price up.
Well, yeah, I can guarantee you if it's it'll probably be infamous rather than famous if I become anything. And it won't be because of rap. But I do catch like that wild hair every now and then to like become like Boogie with a Hoodie version 2.0, where like you don't show your face. I just like come out with dad raps and yeah, like crush like everybody. It's like, dude, I like came up and like the battle rap scene in Chicago, like in like the early 2000s, like I was like the only white dude in the club. So definitely interesting experience. Happy to touch back more on that. But I went back and got my undergrad, small state school in Illinois, graduated right into the teeth of the Great Recession, had no idea what I wanted to do with life, but like community service had always been really important to me. So I enlisted in the Army in 2011 as a crypto linguist. The recruiters couldn't tell me what that meant, but they were like, you're going to go learn a language. It's like, which one? They're like, we don't know. Okay, great. So Leaving basic training, they hand you a manila folder that says like, don't open this until you get to your next duty station. And as soon as the bus is like out of eyeshot of the drill sergeants, you're like tearing into this manila folder. Like what I get. And I really wanted Chinese, but I ended up learning Arabic. So I went to the Defense Language Institute, learned Arabic, zero to professional competency in 64 short weeks. Then found out that Arabic linguists sit in windowless rooms all day and translate. It was like, this job sounds horrible. Like my recruiter lied to me, right? It's like the most common phrase in the military.
Yeah. So do crypto linguists, do they deploy? Like, how does that work? Cause is it remote? Like what does that entail? Cause in 2011, the army was, the op tempo was very high.
Yeah, things were popping, right? That there was a reason why I got Arabic and not Chinese, right? I mean, like Iraq was still hot and heavy. So the intelligence community splits like its linguist assets, like kind of into two camps, either your tactical or strategic. So like tactical side, like deploys, strategic sits like at NSA buildings, at Fort Gordon or whatever, and you don't get to bring your cell phone into the building with you, right? So most linguists start off in the strategic path. I was lucky enough to be in Arabic class with a Green Beret. And I was like, when I found out what linguists did, I was like, how do I get out of this? This sounds awful, right? And so this Green Beret was like, well, Colin, like you should come and work for Special Forces. That sounds like a lot more your speed. And I was like, yes, how do I do that? Right. So, I think I might be the only enlisted trainee in the history of the Army to get my orders changed three times while I was still like not MOS qualified. Like I hadn't even finished my training path yet. But so dropped the airborne package and ended up trading orders I started off at Gordon. Then I got orders for Vincenza once I had the airborne package. And then I swapped orders from Vincenza to Fifth Group with another enlisted Arabic linguist. Like I, kind of pitched it to him like, look, man, if I was single, I would want to go to Italy, And so he was like all about it. I was like, look how close Ibiza is. And so sold him on the idea and he took those orders and I went to group. And so over there, what linguists do is carry collection equipment in backpacks and basically tell Green Berets where the terrorists are hiding. So the job function was telling the team, hey, that are the guy we want in that building, or being like, hey, guys, there's way too many terrorists coming. We got to pop smoke and get out of here. Right. That was,
yeah, it's more of like an intel. That's kind of like an intel, like targeting type role.
Yeah.
For anyone listening, because that really young in your career, it's pretty uncommon. Like a lot, most people that work in Special Forces they go to the regular army first. Then there's some gating that goes, if you're a regular soldier, an infantryman, you got to go through many schools, lots of training, but because you had a niche job, then they had a need, you went there right away. I would equate that in the real estate world of like, hey, you're going to go work facilities for like the New York Life Building. And instead you're like, now you're like the top, like you're working in the top brokerage in New York City. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's like a huge, huge change in job rec, and you got good locations being posted in Vincenza, Italy. So that's
I traded out of Vincenza and went to Fort Campbell. In
okay. Still not bad. Not bad, but so not bad. Italy.
Like great job, not as great of a location, but like, you're absolutely right. Is you get to cut off this huge chunk of the trajectory. And, just for clarification there, I was not Special Forces. I wore a maroon beret, not a green one.
I got you.
But just for the non-army folks out there, like there's a huge distinction between those two colors of hats, right? And like, beretism is what we called it. It's real, right? I was a support guy, right? But again, definitely a lot more responsibility, a lot more high pace than I would have, like of a job than I would have had if I'd sat at Gordon or, sat at NSA and done translation. But so to finally wrap up how this all works into the real estate, I had no formal like financial training whatsoever, like through high school, through college. I was a comms major, right? And that I find out like, I got married and they're like, hey, here's this basic allowance for housing. It's like, non-taxable stipend to live at, Fort Campbell. I could either rent an apartment, for me and the wife or whatever. Or lots of people bought houses. And so I sort of sat down and just calculated what the differences were. I was like, well, I'm going to buy a house. So I got a house on a VA loan, right? Like a starter home, a 3-2, 1,100 square feet for, 113,000, in 2013, put $0 into it. And then when the next duty station came up, I was going to go teach Arabic at DLI, had the options of like, do I sell this or, do I rent it out? And so again, I sort of sat down and said, all right, well, here's what I think I can rent it for. My mortgage is nothing. I have like $0 in this house. So if I'm renting it out, I'm basically making infinity profit, right? And that's where that was the gateway drug, right? Is I had, changed duty stations. Now I've got an out of state property manager and a house in Tennessee with an influx of like soldiers, Air Force people, like just service members coming into the Fort Campbell area. So like a really great base of tenants and like pretty, decent turnover. And that was how it all started. Was just that one starter home in Tennessee.
So I've asked other people that have come on that were military veterans this question, and you kind of answered it. It's the question is, why do so many veterans get involved into real estate? And I think you kind of checked like every box in my mind of why vets do it. You have access to really high leverage at good terms, which is a VA loan. You could, at those prices, you can pretty much go 100% levered. And we all live in cities where most generally in military base areas, most of the homes are rented as opposed to owned. So you have a ton of property management companies or third-party management availability. They cash flow and military vets get great debt and we move a lot. And you can, so you can repeat this process to a certain extent. That's it. That's why so many vets end up in real estate. It's like, there is an advantage, there is somewhat of an advantage. That's cool. So what happened next?
Let's see. So then, moved back to California, had my son, in 2015, Owen came along and, we bought a house in California also on a VA loan. Right. So now it's again, a 0% down house in, San Juan Batista, which is inland from like the Monterey Peninsula in California. And, the house in Tennessee is going well, right? Like my mortgage was $270 and I'm renting it out started out at $850 and got it up to $1,000 after a couple of years. And so, I mean, it's like an incredible return, even if you had put a down payment on the house. Right. And, one of the big reasons I went from group to teaching Arabic was I got injured while, getting ready, to go to a really hard training. And as I'm rehabbing, I like got really interested in finance and business and was like, I knew I couldn't continue on at fifth group. Cause my body was broken, doc said, you'll be lucky to ever run again. And, so I hatched this like go to business school plan. So it started off as like, oh, now I'm it's so funny. It started off with Dave Ramsey's like money makeover. Right. And then I'm reading about mutual funds and the ones that he'd suggested. I'm like, wow, these are really expensive mutual funds. So then I'm like looking at different mutual funds. And then all of a sudden I'm like trading ETFs and trading options and telling everybody about it. And I was like, I got to go to business school. So needed 3 more years of active duty to get the government to pay for the MBA. And that's why I went back to teach Arabic. And got out of the Army in 2018, got into UC Berkeley, did my MBA at Haas. And while I was there, me and a partner started up like a real estate investment company, like a sort of a joint venture where, we were buying more real estate out of state using out of state property managers. And that was, the toe dip in, and boom. It was so long ago. It seems like it was only yesterday, but, it was about 2019, I guess, is when I bought, my second property. How we found the market was my brother, that was my partner, had lived in like the Pittsburgh area and I'd been through Northeast Ohio a whole bunch of times. It was like, hey, man, like I think there's something to this area. And, I was at the very beginning of stages of business school. So I'm like, well, that'll give me some opportunity to sort of flex these new like market research analytical methods. And so, tested the thesis and said, okay, this could really work out. And, we bought our first duplex together in 2019.
Very cool. Very cool. And do you do all of your investments out of state?
My entire real estate portfolio is in Northeast Ohio, except for the house that I still own in California. Yeah. So sold the house in Tennessee, took all those profits, dumped it right into Northeast Ohio. Like the yields were just way higher.
Yeah. Yeah. They are. So I have a question. What are the upsides and downsides of out-of-state investing, in your opinion?
Yeah. So great question. Upsides, probably harder to come up with off the top because it's also market dependent, right? But I think there's a real risk in people who think that the best investment property is the one like down the street from them, you know? Like I don't want to be somebody who like fixes your roof or fixes your toilet. Like everybody's heard sort of like that adage of getting the 3 a.m. toilet call. I don't know if that's necessarily true, but for me, like living in California, like real estate investing was probably just too far out of reach, right? The barriers were too high. The capital requirements were too high. Plus it's not a super landlord friendly state, you know, like there's, a lot of things that go into it that I just didn't want to touch. So, for me, like big advantages of being out of state is that it's kind of far away and it's sort of become an afterthought, right? Like I let somebody manage it, like somebody else manages it. That's good. But that's a two-sided coin, right? Is that because it's out of state, I am not hands-on. I'm not necessarily the one driving the process and I have to delegate a lot and put a lot of trust into my property managers.
Yeah, I agree. I think, I mean, if we're being honest, I think a lot of the people that are doing out-of-state investing, I myself included, are people who live on the coasts investing inland for more yield, which makes it generally gives you a little bit more margin for error and also allows you to be a little bit more short-term minded. When you're first starting out in real estate and you're trying to like get assets under management, you're not like every investment doesn't feel like a 20 to 30 year investment for a lot of people. It's like, I have to get money off this thing. It needs to kick off cash flow today or next month or in 6 months from now. If you're in California, it's really hard to do that unless you have a ton of money or your family has money or you're starting a fund or something.
Yeah.
What are some of the pitfalls though? Like what are the things where you're like, oh man, I messed that up or I could mess this up being out of state?
Yeah. I mean, the list is long, right? I think one of the other, you know, negatives that I didn't bring up in the initial question is that like banks hate to lend to you like out of state. If you don't live there, a lot of times they'll be like, oh, it's an investment property and it's out of state. And then like the rates go up. Like local banks don't necessarily want to deal with you because you are outside of their footprint, right? Like I get that all the time that like local banks just aren't interested because I don't live there, don't pay taxes there, even though I have, you know, an LLC there. Other big pitfalls, like the diligence isn't all that easy, right? If you want to actually go and get eyes on a property, you're flying somewhere, right? I mean, that takes time. And so then it's, you know, is this still sort of like a side hustle weekend business for you? Or like if you're flying somewhere and looking at something and trying to meet up with a seller, you know, a lot of it, you have to just put so much trust in others, right? And it can go wrong. And it has. Like I've had bad property managers out of state that, you know, we had to fire, had to let go. There was like possible litigation. Like luckily it didn't get to that, but it could have, you know, pretty easily. And then again, like I said, it's you're not the one driving the process. So if you have this big bias for action, you're kind of sitting on your hands hoping that somebody else is going to execute that bias for you. And that's really difficult, you know, when you're like, hey, I want to like we could turn this over in 2 weeks, right? Like why isn't it done? And they're like, well, they're busy. Like, get it done.
Like, yeah. Yeah. There's definitely vendors and people can like kind of target the out of state investor. It's kind of slow roll the work, which is somewhat of a problem too. I think another challenge, labor is definitely a huge challenge for out of state investors. We have facilities out of state and when we do have to rehire, it does probably take us a little bit longer than if we live down the street, right? Because we don't know everybody there. I think that's one. I think the other thing is, sometimes you lose the compounding effects of long-term relationships. If you live in a city and it's the only place you invest, like if you're an investor in New York City, it's gotta be the only place you invest because it's so big and there's so many players. But if you stick around for long enough, it's like, you meet the same people at all the dinners, you see the same properties turn over a couple of times. You're like, oh, I know what that thing was priced at back in 2012. So you kind of have like all this context that it's almost impossible for an out-of-state person to maintain all those relationships, all that historical data and kind of hold on to that. So I think there's some loss of compounding there. I think the biggest benefit though for out-of-state people is it's either yield in like in your case, or in my case, it's like the top of your funnel is bigger, you know, like you're basically just expanding the top of your sales funnel. Like instead of having 10,000 properties in it, if you're an opportunist, like we're looking for a specific opportunity. Now there's 50,000 or whatever the number is. So it's interesting. Like there's all these like gives and takes. And sometimes I'm always like, what's better? Are we making the right call? I think we are, but it's good to ask yourself, I think, once in a while.
Yeah, totally. And then you also mentioned like this idea of, you know, trying to get money now and make the property work today. I have actually taken the opposite view where I look at it as a piggy bank, you know, somewhere where I'm stashing money, like long-term hold, have like no intention of selling. The only property that I've sold in Northeast Ohio was because like I bought, you know, my brother out in the early parts of 22. And like, that was the only reason we really sold is I was like, hey, well, we've got to chop this up. Like there's some cash that needs to get settled on both sides. So like here, let's, you know, take a couple of chips off the table. But yeah, I mean, I'm with you too. Like you don't get to go to the city, you know, planning committee meeting if you don't live there and find out that they're planning on building school Y here, or they're like going to fix the roads, or, you know, where they're putting, you know, the next Chick-fil-A or like whatever, like you miss out on all that stuff. And like, yeah, labor's hard too. But I think what that forces the out-of-state investor to do, or at least the one who has a chance to be successful, is like putting systems in place, like record keeping, maintaining logs of like who you've talked to, what work they did, like maintaining invoices and receipts and being like, oh yeah, I worked with this person before, this company before, they did me right. You know, and then like you have to cultivate those relationships as best you can. And then when you do show up in town, you know, in addition to maybe doing DD on whatever acquisition you're targeting, you're also trying to meet all these people that you've only ever talked to, you know, talked on the phone with.
Yeah, I agree. So now you're out of state, but you are targeted. So, and you're doing small multifamily. Is that that's accurate, right? Like you're really like 2 to 4, maybe up to 6. Is that kind of your sweet spot?
Yeah. So, so let me just like start back again. So we went, you know, partnered up in 19. We're looking at like 2 to 4 unit, like duplexes or like quads, right? And we went from 0 you know, units to 10 units, in the beginning, sort of midway through 20. So me and my brother. Right. And then, I guess at the very end of 20 was when I stumbled upon Retweet and like, boom, here's this whole world, this whole wealth of information that I didn't know existed. And, you know, part of it is you're like, wow, I've done everything wrong up to this point. And then part of it is like, well, I'm doing some things right. But like, what else can I sort of, you know, piecemeal together and like take and implement on my side. So after my brother and I split in the beginning of 22, I was like, all right, I think I'm going to just try to acquire as many properties as I can. Cause I just got an offer at McKinsey. Right. So I'm like, all right, I'm going to start at McKinsey in 9 months. I'm going to throw as much gasoline on this fire as I possibly can for the next like 8 months until my start date. And then I'm going to just stop acquiring. I'm just going to stabilize and like hold what I got. Right. So when the split took place, and my brother and I parted ways, I went down, you know, we started with 10, I left with one duplex. And then in 8 months, I went from 2 units to 40. And part of that was finding people on Twitter, like, and reading through threads of like how to build like a legitimate sales funnel for off-market acquisitions.
Right.
But so yeah, now the smallest that I have is a duplex. The biggest is a 6 unit.
That's awesome. So that's a big jump. So how did you do that? Because 2022, we entered real estate around the same time, and there was definitely a difference from like second half 2020, which is when demand was kind of like slow, a little slower because there was all this fear in the market. The difference between that environment and like mid 2022 in terms of competitiveness was like, it's like playing a different sport, in my opinion. So like, how did you overcome that to get things to pencil and get it all to work and get that funnel filled? Like take me through that, because it's not easy to do. It's pretty hard.
Yeah. Well, so first, like, let's start with how the funnel was built, right? So, we'd always just like gone on Redfin or like had our property manager tell us about a property, like some investor was selling one off. And then I was like, how do I get these cheaper? Right. Like there's gotta be a way where I can see more deals that could possibly pencil. And the answer was off market. Right. So I'm like, okay, there's CoStar and there's Crexie and there's, you know, Reonomy. But so what I did is our, our county assessor has like an ArcGIS software on there with all the layers on it. I used that like when I was in the Army. So I sort of knew how to add layers onto this ArcGIS software. And I put in like the property codes for 4 to 19, you know, family properties. And then boom, it just like spits out all of the listings in the entire county that fit that criteria. So now I've got all the property addresses and all the owner names. I hire somebody on Fiverr to go and do like the skip tracing and got all of those numbers. Mm-hmm. Now I've got like 6,000 something numbers. And I'm like, well, there's no way I'm going to sit here and call these people. That sounds horrid. So then I started with Mojo, which is, you know, like an online CRM call center in the cloud, started there, put together like a cold calling script, and then hired two people from the Philippines to do the cold calling for me. Right. And that's how we built it out. And, you know, happy to talk about how that structure went. But then the second question was about, you know, how did we continue to make deals pencil? And I think this is what's interesting about out-of-state investing as well, especially flyover cities, is, you know, in the great financial crisis, these places dropped, but they were never like that high to begin with as far as like price point, right? And it was like a slow inching upward. And from, you know, in 20, we were buying duplexes for like $30,000, you know, that were renting for $1,000 gross, you know, not 1,000 per side, but just total, right? So already you're really, really favorable. In 21, those same $30,000 duplexes went to like 42. And, but it like still wasn't this massive barrier to entry where you're going to end up, you know, jacking up the entire deal because of the price point entry. It was still fine. And like rents had moved along with in lockstep. And then like when sort of like the height of 21 into 22, it just didn't really move. Like prices didn't go up that much higher. Like they just sort of stayed there. And, so that means things still worked. It just wasn't as attractive as before. It's just that nothing had really changed. The core thesis hadn't changed. And I was able to still, you know, go forward without deals no longer being able to pencil because of price points.
Yeah. So it was less appreciation in the short term, which, you know, so your yields were relatively stable, which is great. But I also find in those cities, because we used to buy a lot of affordable housing and flip a lot of affordable housing too. I find those to have the highest conversion for direct to seller marketing too. Yep. Like if it takes, 10,000 leads to get a contract in Westchester County, New York, then maybe it's every 6,000 in Dayton, Ohio, you know, just the way that the numbers end up working.
Yeah.
How much of that, just for context, because what you explained before is like, it costs some money, right? You got a dialer, you mentioned Mojo, so you can call fast. Yeah. You got to buy some phone numbers because you're going to get spam. You're going to mark as spam on your numbers. So you have to buy extra phone numbers. You hired somebody. If someone was coming out of the military, another vet, and they're like, hey, I want to buy 10 houses this year and I want them to get a 10% cash on cash return. You're going to be like, you got to do it off market, right?
Yep.
How much money do they have to budget to do this? How much money they are willing to lose? Because you might not get anything. Like how much do you have to be willing to lose to do this?
Yeah, I think like sales cycle time for this type of business is, you know, I don't know, 2 weeks to 10 years, right? So like the funnel, like once you've got them in the top, there's no reason you can't continue to call these people, right?
Yeah.
I think once you've, especially for vets, I found, and then this is anecdotal and a complete guess, but I bet it's true, especially in like Midwestern towns, is like when you have a conversation with a seller and they find out that you're a human and you bring up that you're a vet, like suddenly they're just more willing to talk to you, is sort of like my thought. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you can sort of keep the funnel alive, but I think like infrastructure setup, how much do you have to be willing to lose? Everything, right? Like everything that you put in. Like, what do you need to start it? Maybe $2,500.
Yeah. I always said $5,000, but yeah, something like that.
Yeah. I mean, I think, well, cause my initial number poll and the owner and address poll, I knew that was good cause it was off the county assessor site. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Very higher confidence.
Higher confidence on that. True. And then I set up the comp structure with the VAs. Like, I think I don't know. I felt like I did a pretty good job on that, where I incentivized not dial time, but like appointment set, right? So their hourly dial time comp was extremely low. But if they set up an appointment with a seller and I had a conversation with that seller, they got a really big bonus. And then if I closed the property, they got like a massive bonus, right?
Got it.
So I think that also made a big difference, and it kept my upfront, you know, expenditures low. And I think it aligned incentives, because if we get to the deal, like, you know, that VA makes a year worth of income, like on one deal. Right. But so every call is important. Right. So I think that's maybe why I was able to keep it a little lower.
That's cool. That's cool. How many top of funnel leads, meaning like phone numbers or sellers, how many do you think it takes to get a deal? Like what is the number? I'm always curious what people say to this. And actually I'm starting to forget our numbers for
some. Yeah. I mean, so like, I think that's harder to pin down, right? Cause the addresses and owner information I knew was 100% right. Right. But the phone numbers and the skip tracing, they give you like the last five that are like associated with that owner, and you could have two owners. You could end up with 10 numbers, right?
Yeah.
So I think my initial list was something like 7,500 numbers, you know?
Yeah.
And I got three deals out of it that I closed on. I like let a lot go, right? Like I had a point where I had so many possible deals that I considered wholesaling, you know? And I was like, I don't think I'm going to do it. It's just like too much hassle to try to learn something this late in the game.
Yeah.
When I was like 7 months before, you know, the McKinsey start. I have 7,000, but again, it's like you get Frank's number, cause he owns, you know, 123 Alpha Street, and you have five numbers that are associated with Frank and only one of them's real. Right. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's like a 1-5 ratio, but then maybe a 2% conversion rate on that. So
yeah,
200 to 1,000 numbers to get one deal maybe.
Yeah. I think in that space, that's probably correct. And like I said before, if you go to in some part of California where you live, I would bet you that number's bigger. Like you need more numbers. It's very, very exactly. Interesting. There's like this calculus that's like kind of market to market with direct seller marketing. That's I always find very interesting. So you are in the affordable housing, single family, it is in small 2-4 month multi space. That's your in Ohio. That's your buy box. Some people would hear those numbers you said before, like the $40,000 house that rents out for gross $1,000. Obviously cash flow is great. But there's the CapEx argument against that business, right? Like, hey, my boiler goes out. Okay. Now your cash on cash return for the year is zero, right? Or whatever. So what do you say to that? And defend the business plan, because I do see people on Twitter be like, hey, I'm not into the affordable housing thing because CapEx can crush all your returns. And sometimes it doesn't make its way into the underwriting that easily. It's hard to predict. So like, what's your argument there?
You know, I have this argument like once a month, well, this discussion, right? This very spirited discussion once a week with my wife. And you know, there's a lot of validity to that exact, mindset that like, hey, HVAC repairs, you replace one HVAC, your entire cash flow is gone for like a year, or you have like one vacancy and you know, it's 2 months, boom, there goes your entire profit for the year. And that's like 100% true. And so what I would say is like a two-part answer. Like one is like, yes, you're right. But like, what about your timeframes? You know? And again, for somebody like me who is never planning to sell, I just have to look at it like long-term and say like, all right, this is all going to smooth itself out over time. You know, if you replace a boiler once, you probably shouldn't have to do it again for 12 years, you know, and over the course of a 30-year loan, like, okay, it's going to smooth out. And then the second one is like, hey, maybe it's just, you know, maybe it's not for you. That's like number two. With like 2A being like, but don't forget about the tax benefits, right? Like I am in an income bracket where I will take all the write-offs that I can get. And, you know, cost segregation is a lovely, lovely thing. So yeah, I think there's a lot of tax benefits, but again, it's like, it's not easy. There are a lot of CapEx requirements. I have seen them, had them, hate them. It's just part of it. Right. But again, I have to think of it not as like a call option that has a 30-day expiration. Like this is a retirement plan. This is a 45-year, 50-year piggy bank.
Yeah, it's true. It's also, I see a lot of people that succeed in affordable housing also eventually get to like a critical mass, you know, where like it's easy to quit if you buy a property and you only have one and it's cash flowing well, and then the roof, you're like, oh man, the roof is bad. And then, so it's going to crush you for the next 4 years. So you quit, right? But then you have 40 doors and then you get to 80 and 100 and it kind of evens out all that stuff. And you're able to get there because you get better conversion on direct seller marketing. And typically you buy at a lower basis relative to market value. So it is an interesting game. It is kind of, it's a little bit unique, that game that I've played it and you're playing. It is a little bit different than what most people do for those reasons.
I mean, part of it too, is I think, you know, we're vets and love torture. I mean, why do you stay in it?
Dude, there's so much truth to that. Like, if someone like fully automated my job and it got too easy, I'd be like, nah, this is.
Yeah, I can't do it anymore.
I need to suffer a little bit. Like, I need some suffering. I'm going to go call an old crusty landlord real quick. Hold on. Like,
it is what it is. Yeah, maybe I'll just take a flight on the weekend and go put some flooring in. Why not? That sounds fun.
Very cool. So what's next? What's the plan? Oh, actually, hold on. We were talking before we came on. You had a horror story where I don't know the story at all, but you mentioned a potential horror story. We said we're going to cover it. What's going on?
Yeah.
You got a deal gone bad.
It's not that it's gone bad. It's that it's gone bad. But again, keeping like the long-term view, like the cost segregation, the tax benefits in mind is sort of what's, you know, kept me sane. And I've thought about like cutting and running so many times. But so last June, found an 18 unit deal. So it's like 3 6-plexes. Each building has, you know, 4 1-bedrooms and 2 studios, and they're all like all identical. Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, where I was in the process is I, you know, was like, I got to throw all the gasoline on this fire. Like, I kind of had an AUM number in my head. And I was like, if I could just close this one, like, I'll be good. Right. And like, so there's like your first flag is that I was thinking about just like, I had the blinders on. I was like wanting to close this one deal. Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's off market. The seller was like a restaurant, you know, a restaurant guy, tired landlord, had inherited these properties from somebody else. You know, and the price looked good, but usually the rule, like you hear the 1% rule a lot, you know, thrown around. Yeah. I wasn't doing anything less than like a 2% rule out there. Like 2% was like the floor. And so on this deal, I was like, I went to 1.5 because I was like, you know what? Like, I can see this working out. Like, this is the big deal that I want. I bet like local regional banks would be more interested because of its size, because of the loan value, like whatever. So, I mean, candidly, I slacked on the DD. Like, I let him send me over his rents. We talked about them. I didn't do the regular like estoppel agreements. I didn't demand to look at bank statements because it was all intertwined with what was happening at his restaurant. I was like, I'm not unfucking this. Like, it's just too wild. And I had an idea of what it could go to and what it should be.
Yeah.
And there was so much meat on the bone. It just felt like there was enough margin for error. And so I got really comfortable. And anyway, ended up closing the deal. And then like a month later, like a once in 30 year rainstorm hits and it floods, right? And we take on 4 feet of water in 2 of the buildings. Oh. And, so this is like one of my first deals that I've done with hard money. And, you know, here, if you learn anything today on this podcast, it's other than Colin talks really fast, is that you should learn that hard money lenders are not required to do flood reports. Like, they don't have to tell you, right? So if it's in a floodplain, they might know, but it's your responsibility as the borrower to go out and get flood insurance. And that's completely different than a regular bank.
I think the principle is the real estate has an assembly line on a regular deal. It's like broker, they have disclosures, they have all this stuff. You have and if you're doing syndication, you have to do a survey, phase 1, PPM, you have to prepare all this stuff. The further you get off the real estate assembly line into the off-market space, like your due diligence, that's it, man. Like, you own all of it. So like, the further you are away from the flagpole, the more stress you have to put on your DD. And I've made mistakes too. One time we thought we bought a regular house and it was a mobile home mixed in with other single families in the area. We ended up not getting our ass kicked on the deal, but huge mistake. And when we were first starting out. So I get it. But anyway, continue.
Yeah. Well, this one, as far as like the ass kicking is still like the bruises and bumps are yet to have like fully been seen. But so, you know, we had this flood. So now four units immediately vacate because of like my lack of pushing the seller on the DD. Like three of the units out of the 18 were already vacant, but and like he had them labeled as like paying, right? And so like the amount of turnover, like right off top, was like 50% plus, like in the units, right? Which is just wild. And so, you know, I'm like trying to renovate the units that aren't flooded. I'm doing the flood mitigation. I'm trying to like get, you know, all this stuff happening. And oh, by the way, like I had just started at McKinsey. Right. And so like, I'm trying to onboard, trying to get into these first projects, and it was just chaos. And, man, it's been an entire year, and luckily the lenders have been nice enough to extend the hard money note. You know, I pay my fees, you know, like, and they've been let me do payment in kind, which is great. Cause I mean, on the other side of it, I think we'll be okay. But like, we've got an appraisal out right now. So cross your fingers, everybody in Twitter land and everybody listening to this podcast, that my appraisal comes back where it should be, so I can finally get off this hard money note, because it's been like a full year. But yeah, we're stabilized and we'll see where it goes. But again, I kind of look at it like, I thought I was going to just get lucky and be able to show up and, you know, raise rents and things were going to be hunky dory, and like wrong. And then the flood like made it worse. But a long-term, again, because like, I'm not that worried about like the CapEx requirements really should have been a down payment, and they weren't, right? So like, there's still enough meat on the bone where it's going to end up working out. Hopefully, and you know, long-term horizon, long-term view, should be okay.
Yeah, I hear you, man. Anyone who says being a landlord is not a job, I mean, once you get to a certain number of doors, it is, for sure. Oh man, I got thunder by my house. I don't know if you can hear that. I'll share some weather stuff too. We have some properties down in Florida, and we bought them, and then the worst hurricane in terms of property damage came 2 months after. Our facilities were okay. We had a little bit of water, but nothing crazy. But our insurance premiums went up 275%. So thankfully we have long-term debt, and it's pretty conservative, and we're okay. But it's going to be pretty hard to recover the cash flow on that deal when your second biggest expense almost triples overnight. So sometimes, like the weather, it can mess you up. Like there's not, and sometimes just not anything you can do about it. So. Good luck out there, everybody.
Insurance premiums in Florida are nuts right now, right? I mean, like, is it just...
Yeah, we just bad timing. Like we expected them to go up because, you know, labor costs are up. We have inflation, all these things, but carriers pulled out of the state because of the damage. So people who got burned came out. So now the people that are remaining in the market, essentially to price gouge everybody and capitalize off that opportunity. It's a risk-adjusted return play for them. I hope it will get better, but right now we're underwriting every deal. We're underwriting deals at $2.90, $3 a square foot for insurance, for self-storage.
What did that
start at? That's a lot. That is a lot.
What was that before the big storm?
In Florida, you'd probably be around one. But if you're in like Georgia, you could do like 0.6, you know, 60 cents, 50 cents.
Wow. So you've gone maybe 3X on the low end to 5X on the high end. Of like what you're
well relative to like a state nearby. Florida has always had higher premiums, but now they're really, really high. So we'll see what happens next year. If we make it through without a big storm, we'll see.
Brutal.
Yeah, super tough. Very, very tough. I would say this, just to tie the knot on that, we try to underwrite deals in Florida a lot. And because a lot of the carriers are basing the insurance based off of square footage, if you can't charge a high rent per square foot, the amount of distress I'm starting to see on those properties is pretty significant. Like if the number is becoming very important because you're carrying those costs and your revenue is not able to make up for it. Like the math just doesn't work out. So there's people that I honestly believe this on small properties, like 600 grand, 700 grand, but it's like, maybe it's like 10,000 square feet. Like that small storage, small multifamily or 2 to 4 unit type people. They might've had something that was stabilized at an 8 cap. It might be a 0 right now. You know what I'm saying? Like if you are charging a low dollar per square foot, there's real distress. So it could be an opportunity for somebody, but we're not really looking for stuff that small. But I'm just calling it out. I was thinking about this all morning. I was like, holy shit, it's pretty crazy.
So in like the smaller storage, would you buy that and expand the storage capacity, or would you just like not look at that deal to begin with?
We looked at a place the other day and like it would have traded probably at like $60 a square foot for the facility a year ago, 2 years ago. And the feedback I got was like, hey, you can get it for 30, you know? And I was like, it doesn't pencil. No. Like it doesn't work. It doesn't work. Like you'd have to be speculating off of insurance. I've never been in that position. So I'm not interested. I don't know how to evaluate this. You know, I don't have inside knowledge on what's going to happen. That's how crazy it is.
So how has that changed where you and John are looking now? Are you not looking in Florida as often? Are you starting to look inland a little bit, or how's it changed what you're thinking about?
But we're still looking. I actually think we might lock up a deal today, but it's in a more in demand area. Like better locations are actually faring better. You know what I'm saying? It's like,
yeah.
So it fetches a little bit more dollars per square foot, I feel good about it. So we're still prospecting, but it does affect our buy box. We can't look at deals that we previously could have looked at. We're mostly looking at Florida and Georgia. We did add a location, and we're starting to do direct seller marketing there too, based off of a location John spent his vacation at. I'm not going to share it yet because I've learned in storage that we can't share stuff with each other. We've been in so many bids with the same people over and over again that it's our asset class is so small that we actually can, like six of us can actually, we'll see each other on bids constantly. So I've learned we have to be, I want to be abundant mindset, but we're in such a scarce resource or asset class that it doesn't really work, unfortunately.
That's tough.
Yeah, but I won't share on the pod.
Well, best of luck on the one. Then hope you get it. Hope you lock it up today, man. That's exciting.
I think so. I hope so. What's next? What's the future like for you?
Yeah. So been in McKinsey for almost a year. Went there for three reasons. First was like see as many business problems as possible in the shortest amount of time. Second was figure out how to be a better business owner/operator, and the third was some exit opportunities. Like, you know, candidly, I'm just too old to be like a McKinsey associate with, you know, two kids at home. Number one's gone well, seen a lot. Number two, I don't know if you'll ever get that in consulting. Like, I think, you know, when people bring us on, it's because people are behaving badly or they, you know, might need a therapist. And you know, three, the exit opportunities have come a little bit earlier than I thought they might. So I'm about to make the jump to a, PE-backed software company. I'll be taking over as CEO here in about 2 weeks.
Dude, that's great. Good for you, man. That's a big deal. We're already an hour in. I wish we left more time to talk about that because that's badass. Are you nervous? How are you feeling?
Yeah, I'm excited and terrified. Like it's definitely mixed feelings. You know, I was really interested in doing, you know, search funds when I got into business school. I've always sort of felt like I'm straddling between like Retweet and SMB Twit. I feel like I'm going to be leaning a little bit more on the SMB Twit now. I'm glad to be doing it this way because it's like a de-risk search fund, you know, in the fact that I didn't have to go out and find the company. I don't have to build all the infrastructure out. It's a fund that owns several other companies, so I can reach out to existing CEOs. You know, they have a finance department. It's already centralized. So I think that there's a lot of sounding boards that wouldn't exist in like a pure, like sort of self-funded search. But you know, at the same time, I've never sold software, right? Never done that before. But you know, I think that's what's great about Vets is our quotient on figure it the fuck out is high. And so that's why I like my chances. I think that's another thing a lot of vets, you know, are willing to do is, you know, we take big risks, especially on ourselves, you know. But I'm excited, but it's going to be a challenge for sure.
That's a good attitude. I love the comment on figure it the fuck out. I think it's, you know, bias towards action, FITFO, the short way to say it's FITFO. If so, you don't get in trouble. You're not supposed to say fuck in public, I guess, all the time. I love that, man. That's really, really cool. Are you hiring a bunch of people too, or are you inheriting the entire staff?
So I am inheriting the staff. Right now it's a team of seven. I'm making my first hire, a director of sales role. I'm like about to send him the offer when I get off of this podcast, which is all really exciting. We'll see about additional hires like moving forward, but you know, software's got really high margins. So like there's room to grow. Yeah. But I kind of want to get in there first and do some like assessing and diagnosing before I, you know, start job posting, right? Mm-hmm. But my guess is we'll probably maybe one or two other sales hires before Q4 is wrapped up.
I love that. My twin brother sells software. My wife's company sells ad services and software. And okay. I'll share the number one lesson I've watched from both of them, because I talk to them about this all the time, is what happens in tech is they do great and the margins are always big. And then, but there's always like pressure to grow, right? And no matter where you're at, like you might have an exit and then you have new investors, you got to keep growing, right? Yeah. And what I've seen all of them do is the same thing, is they get to some level of maturity and then the product starts to like be somewhat stable. And then they're like, you know, we're just going to grow revenue by doubling the sales force. It's so easy. Yeah. And I think that worked when the economy was just humming and all the stimmy money was out there. Now they're all untangling their sales forces because, you know, ultimately in technology, like if the product doesn't improve and the value doesn't improve or the marketing doesn't improve or something, like the sales force can only do so much, right? It's like the same thing with direct seller marketing. It's like you have this number of leads and you can't throw 10,000 VAs at those leads. You know what I'm saying? It's the same exact problem that real estate investors have, but everyone fucks it up. That's my one thought on software.
Yeah, no, I mean, and you're right. I think, you know, and this is, again, maybe some SMB twit people will hear this, but like anybody who thinks that going into a business that they've never run before is going to be easy is, frankly, like, that's a lot of hubris. Like they should
business is hard.
Business is hard. You know, I think straight you should up. Check that at the door. I would say that tech's like rampant Salesforce expansion during the pandemic is actually proving a benefit for us because we have access to a talent pool that we might not have had access to if there hadn't been down rounds in VC land, right?
Yeah, so that's true.
Looking at the talent pool for the director of sales, it was leveled up considerably just due to the fact that folks were leaving like early stage SaaS companies, early stage tech, you know, tech jobs because like there were down rounds. And then, you know, Silicon Valley Bank, obviously, you know, played a big role in it as well. But yeah, no, it's going to be interesting. I'm pumped. We're also in what I would venture to say is a durable market. Like I wouldn't have left the cushy McKinsey, you know, paycheck if it hadn't sort of been the right conditions. And this is not a turnaround as much as like a realignment. And when I saw like our current customer list, I was able to take a lot of comfort out of it and say like, oh, okay. It's not just like all net new and calling people and trying to sell them something brand new. What we're selling is already used by a lot of our customers. And we have some big heavy hitters on our list. And I'm like, well, look, expand our current accounts.
You know? You think there's already fit. There's already like a product market fit. That's
good. Yeah, definitely. It's not venture. You know, it's a profitable company, has been for a long time. And again, it's not like a full-on transformation. There's a lot of institutional knowledge in the company already that I plan on leaning on. You know, surrounding myself with the most experienced people so that we can be successful and like sort of look at myself as the leader who is going to be empowering and blocking or unblocking like resources that like those experienced people need to succeed and just helping, you know, people focus on what matters, right?
I love it. I think I'm going to wrap it up right there. I'm going to conclude with the final thought after talking about that is if you're a real estate company or somebody out there looking to hire people, hire a vet. I think that's kind of my conclusion based on your story. Colin, it was great. Great having you on. I appreciate you being here. And to our viewers, we'll see you guys next week. Colin, on the way out, just tell us where everyone can find you.
Ooh, well, I haven't officially made the move yet, and we're still in the transition period from McKinsey. So you can find me on Twitter at Call the Midlife. That's COL, Call the Midlife. And yeah, that's where I'll be.
All right, everybody. See you next week. Peace.